This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So moving on, our next speaker needs a very little introduction. Nora Tarot, clearly recognized as a leader in the field of viral hepatitis, and currently Nora is the director of the Viral Hepatitis Center at UCSF, and you see all these breakthroughs and excitement about hepatitis C, and there's nobody better than Nora to review the data for us. Nora, please.
Sorry, I have to load my slide. So I think maybe y'all want to stand up and stretch. It's been a long afternoon. I want y'all sort of feeling okay. So first of all, thank you all for coming. It's always a pleasure to see you all. And I've been doing this a talk related to hepatitis C, I think, almost every year. And it should be at the top. Oh, click on here. Date modified. And it should be at the top. There you go. And I was thinking about it that I think, you know, I don't know if there's many other people who can say that I sort of started my career when Hep C was, you know, they finally had a diagnostic test for it. And, you know, before I retire, it's going to be a disease that will probably disappear in terms of really being a huge issue in terms of transplantation. So it's a really remarkable time. And it's actually, I think I've been wanting, you know, preparing you for this talk for several years now, and we're finally here. I'm going to review the data that actually is in non-transplant patients first, really kind of to set the stage. For those of you that know this data well, it may be a little bit repetitive, but it really helps us to understand how we might use the drugs in our waitlisted patients and also post-transplant. So I'm going to walk you through that. My disclosures are at the bottom. I do have a fair amount of grant support as well as serve on some advisory boards. For any of the companies that aren't listed, I would like to be doing studies with them. So. Okay, so this is our standard of care today. If you're going to write a prescription, it's going to be for bosipravir or telaprevir in conjunction with PEG and ribavirin. This was a remarkable step forward, approved 2 years ago and used in both our waitlisted patients and our transplant patients. This was a huge step forward. And I'm not going to show the data, actually, of what we achieved with this, but, for example, post-transplant, our success in terms of eradicating HCV post-transplant went from 20% up to 60%. So this was a huge step forward, but it was very, very complex. And you all have been working with these drugs, and you know that one of the challenges is just using them. And the complexity and the burden to the patients is substantial. But without doubt, as the first DAAs, this was a huge step forward. But it was only for genotype 1. We didn't have any new therapies for genotypes 2 through 6. And I think what's really exciting is that now we can talk about therapies to other genotypes as well. So as you know or may not know, the FDA panel unanimously recommended the approval of 2 new DAAs, and we're anticipating their arrival within the next several weeks. Sumeprivir, which is a second-wave protease inhibitor, is also targeting genotype 1 and has been evaluated in both treatment-naive and experienced patients. I'll show you a little bit of that data. This is very much along the model of what we've had with protease inhibitors so far, in that it's used in combination with PEG, interferon, and ribavirin, and used in a response-guided therapy approach. Sovosbuvir is sort of the first in class for a nucleoside polymerase inhibitor. So it's, we anticipate, going to be approved for genotypes 1 through 4. It's going to be approved for treatment naive for genotypes 1 through 4. And in treatment experienced patient populations, I think it's a little less clear, but at least for genotype 2, 3, and how much more broadly the FDA will go, I'm not sure. But I'm going to show you data related to both treatment naive and experienced populations. So the really exciting thing is that for the genotype 2, 3 patients, for the first time we'll have a treatment that doesn't involve interferon. So Sovosbuvir is going to be approved for genotypes 1 and 4 with PEG, interferon, and ribavirin, but for genotypes 2 and 3, it will be an all-oral therapy only. So this is amazing. We're there. So I'm going to review with you what I think is going to be the expected standard of care in a month or two. Certainly in 2014, in that treatment arena, this is what I think we're going to have to work with. I don't think we're going to have any other new therapies, although hopefully by the end of 2014 there'll be other all-oral combinations on the scene. But for genotype 1, I think we'll still have bocilpivir and telaprevir available. How much we'll use them, I think, will be very questionable, because it'll be very easy to see that if you want to use a protease inhibitor-based therapy, that cimaprevir offers advantages over bocilpivir and telaprevir, although they've not been compared head-to-head. And then, as I mentioned already, for genotype 1 and 4, we'll also have sofosbuvir with PEG and ribavirin. But note the substantial difference between sofosbuvir with PEG and ribavirin is it's now only 12 weeks of treatment, in contrast to what we've been doing thus far, which is using a response-guided therapy in which the minimum duration of therapy is usually 24 to 28 weeks and may, in some patients, be out to 48 weeks. And then, as I mentioned, for genotype 2, 3, it's an all-oral combination of sofosbuvir with ribavirin, again, for 12 weeks. But I'm going to show you data that tell us that we need to extend that therapy out to 16 or even 24 weeks for more difficult-to-treat populations. All right, so let me, and also I'll just mention here that I am going to get to transplant. It is the thing that I'm actually the most excited about, but I feel like I'm going to do it second, because I sort of feel like I have to set the stage with the non-transplant patients first. But to let you know that we now, I think, can say that most of the pharmaceutical companies are moving into the transplant arena concurrent with their studies in non-transplant patients. This is really a big change. You know, all these years we had to wait for the drugs to be approved, and then finally we'd start to get studies in transplant patients. Now they see this group of patients as being high need, kind of an urgent, you know, need to get new therapies. And so as the drugs are being tested in non-transplant patients, we're doing studies concurrent in transplant, which is really a remarkable kind of, I have to really give credit to the pharmaceutical companies for taking the chance. And actually for the FDA as well, for sort of acknowledging that it is important for them to do those studies. And so that's why I have data to show you with sofosbuvir and ribavirin. And I can tell you also that we have several other all-oral combinations that we're currently studying at UCSF with other combinations of drugs, really reflecting sort of the change in terms of the emphasis on transplant patients. All right, so let's start with genotype 1. So there's some common themes, I think, if we think about the new direct antiviral drugs, cimaprevir and sofosbuvir, in terms of genotype 1. First of all, the SVR rates are higher. Secondly, response-guided therapy is used, but not consistently, as I showed you already. Some are not going to use response-guided therapy anymore. You're going to start to see there's subtype differences, meaning there's a difference now in responses between genotype 1A and 1B. So in the past, it was all genotype 1. Now you really have to look at what's the subtype of your patient, because that's going to influence the response rates. And consistent across every drug that is out there, for the most part, is that cirrhosis reduces the SVR rate. Now, not substantially, but there's always this differential between cirrhotics and non-cirrhotics. We'll see that the tolerability and side effects are much improved with these new drugs compared to what we have now, and drug-drug interactions are less, and finally, pill burden is going to go down. So looking first at cimaprevir, PEG and ribavirin, this genotype 1, and it's to highlight some of those things I just spoke to you about. So first of all, if you look, overall SVR rates in the genotype 1 patients that are naive is around 80%, and in this particular case, the 1A, 1B doesn't look that much different. They actually have another study that showed a little bit more of a differential. You can see response rates, not surprisingly, are also very high in relapsers, but tend to drop off when we look at the previously treated patients, the partials, and the null responders. And it's in those more difficult-to-cure groups that we see that differential between 1A and 1B be more emphasized. And it's pretty consistent across all the studies that generally the 1Bs do better than 1As. What about the presence of baseline polymorphisms? This is also kind of a new issue that we have to think about. It was shown with cimaprevir that if you have a mutation, or if you have a polymorphism, the Q80K mutation in that individual who happens to be genotype 1A, it's only seen in genotype 1A patients, that significantly influences the efficacy of the therapy. So if you look at the bars, the genotype 1B patient, this is again treatment-naive patients, 85% SVR rate. If you have a genotype 1A patient who does not have the Q80K mutation, it's also about 85%. But if you do have the mutation, you can see that their SVR rates drop off considerably. And there's a suggestion that then this would be the kind of, if we're going to use this drug, that we would have to test for this polymorphism in our genotype 1A patients before we'd embark upon treatment. And then again, this issue of the stage of disease. So you can see again that with this new protease inhibitor plus PEG and ribavirin, there's a decrement in response as the stage of disease increases. So as the what I didn't mention, but I'll say now, one of the huge advantages, though, of cimiprevir is it's a once-a-day pill. So as a protease inhibitor, certainly has that advantage. And I will show you the side effect profile a little bit later, but also a significant improvement in terms of side effects over what we currently see with bosiprivir and telaprevir. So this is a new protease inhibitor for us, 80 to 85% SVR rate. Most of the patients in the study actually achieved an RVR and therefore only needed 24 weeks of treatment, so that's also quite good. They didn't see recommendation, I don't think, that we have to adjust the duration for the presence or absence of cirrhosis. But I did show you that there are those things that affect the response rates, including stage, partial and null responses, IL-28B, which I didn't show you but does affect it, and most importantly, the genotype 1A and the presence of that polymorphism. All right, so now moving on to sofosbuvir and PEG and ribavirin. This is what we anticipate is going to be the approved therapy for genotype 1. And again, I'm going to show you that you'll see there's a 1B, 1A differential of about a 10% difference in SVR rates. There's also a differential by IL-28B, always higher in CC than non-CC, and again, about a 10% difference in SVR rates between those with cirrhosis and those without. But overall, the SVR rates with sofosbuvir and PEG ribavirin are about 90% in the sort of, you know, the best patients, not sort of most responsive patients, and about 80% in those that have these, what we'll consider to be factors that influence response rates. So to summarize, the sofosbuvir data, 90% success. I've shown you that there's some decrement in SVR rates with certain characteristics. The unfortunate thing, perhaps, is that we don't have, or we have very limited data on efficacy in treatment-experienced patients. So I showed you some cimiprevir data where we looked at the partial and null responders. I don't have similar data to show you for sofosbuvir, PEG, and ribavirin. We do have a little bit of data from the transplant experience, which I think I'll share with you, but to make the statement that there actually is not, at this time, sort of a large data set in treatment-experienced patients that we can draw upon to know how this drug is going to perform in that patient population. So in terms of safety and tolerability, the message is just very simple. Both of these new medications offer simplicity. They're once-a-day dosing. They have less side effects than what we, I think, can anticipate seeing with our current therapy. In the case of cimiprevir, there are some still instances of pruritus. There's also noteworthy of photosensitivity, and one needs to be aware that there is a mild and transient hyperbilirubinemia that occurs because of a transporter inhibition, very much comparable to what's seen with some of the HIV protease inhibitors. This is not something that requires treatment to be discontinued, but just something you need to be aware of. So that's, I think, what we see is going to be the approved therapies within the next few weeks. Of course, this still includes PEG interferon, and so safety and tolerability issues remain particularly for our patients with cirrhosis. And we are going to be challenged because we have to use interferon by the need to deal with cytopenias. There's the persistent risk for infection, and still this risk that the patient who's cirrhotic and who we treat may decompensate. Now, to some extent, if you're using a treatment course that's shorter, many of these safety tolerability issues may be less. So if you're going to treat somebody for 12 weeks with a PEG-based therapy versus what we do currently, which is 48 weeks, one could envision that that might be a little bit smoother. And I would submit to you that I think that this is going to be a therapy that actually has some benefit in our patients who are cirrhotic, but I would say are well-compensated cirrhotics. I think the bigger challenge, actually, is not so much that the PEG interferon is going to be difficult to use, but it's just that I think both patients and providers are becoming what I call interferon unwilling. And that is, patients don't want to take. They know that their all-orals are out there, and they want all-oral therapy. And I think providers are getting less and less enthusiastic about using a PEG interferon-based therapy as well. So I think the biggest kind of hurdle, really, to these newly approved drugs is that many individuals will say, oh, maybe I'll just wait a little bit longer because the all-oral therapies are coming. I think for our patients that are on the wait list for transplant, the patients that are cirrhotic, I would argue that we shouldn't wait, and that We should look at these data, and then I'm going to show you some data with interferon-free therapy, and look at how we might be able to use these drugs well in our patients who are heading towards transplant, either with or without HCC. So we do have a little bit of data about interferon-free therapies for genotype 1, and I would say that many of us are going to try to use interferon-free. It's just a matter of what are we going to be able to get our hands on. But many more will be here, I think, within about a 12 to 18-month period. There's many phase 3 studies with all-oral combinations that are being done currently. But between now and when those other drug combinations are approved, what can we work with? Well, one would be we could just use sofosbuvir and ribavirin. And drop the peg, and I'm going to show you some data to give you an idea of what you might expect. And the other is maybe we try to do some off-label use and put sofosbuvir and cimiprivir together, and I have some data to share you about that. So here's the SPARE trial. It was published in JAMA just recently. It was done by the NIH, and they took genotype 1 treatment-naive patients and treated them just with dual therapy. So this is interferon-free, and you can see that it's a kind of a mixed cohort, but they were treatment naive, but they had African Americans, for example, and a fair proportion of patients that had an unfavorable IL-28B genotypes. So this is a perhaps more difficult treatment group. And I want you to just focus on the bottom set of bars, which are the patients that included all stages of fibrosis. The light blue bar is individuals who had early stage disease. But since I'm trying to focus your attention on your cirrhotic patient, I think it's best to look at the bottom two bars. And what you can see here is that just with dual therapy that they achieved a sustained virological response in about 50% of patients who were treated with a lower dose of ribavirin, 600 milligrams, and about a 70% success in patients who received sort of what we consider to be full dose ribavirin. So the message is it works. It works, but not as well as when we put peg interferon on. If we add interferon and treat for 12 weeks, we can get this number up to 90%. Or 80% if they have cirrhosis. But this is, I think, very encouraging data to show that if you just use dual therapy and if you use particularly sort of weight-based dosing of ribavirin, that a substantial proportion of patients will achieve cure. And then what about putting together sofosbuvir and cimiprivir? This will definitely be off-label. There are no intentions, I think, at the moment to allow these to be used in an on-label fashion. But there's a very nice set of data that have come out using initially, patients that had, in the blue bars, an early stage of fibrosis, and then more recently, data from those that had F3, F4 disease. This was a treatment trial. I'm just going to show you the data for 12 weeks of this treatment. And you can see it's pretty impressive, right? That essentially 95 to 100% of the patients with 12 weeks of treatment achieved SVR. And anemia, which you'd predict would be an issue with using ribavirin, was seen really in the patients, I flipped those around, actually. The anemia was only seen in the group that got ribavirin, and actually it didn't appear to make that much of a difference in terms of the SVR rate. So it looks like you could actually eliminate the ribavirin and therefore eliminate the issue related to anemia. So this looks very promising. I think the challenge will be, can you get your hands on it? So where do I think you're going to be this year? Treatment for genotype 1, I think you're going to have basically a few options, the peg-based option, and then you can try to do combinations without peg interferon. And I think the sofosbuvir ribavirin certainly should be considered in patients that are peg interferon intolerant, unable. I certainly think that would be applicable to many of the waitlisted patients. And then cimiprivir and sofosbuvir, I think, as mentioned, is going to be off-label. I think challenges actually getting access. Remember that the groups that have a reduced rate of SVR cirrhotics, the prior null responders, the non-CCs, and the 1A subtype. So as you're looking at your patient and trying to decide what to go with, just remember that as you accumulate these, I'm going to say, lesser response characteristics, that you might see a decrement from this like 90% that we've come to expect or 80% that we've come to expect, that actually we might see some decrement. But there's no doubt that this is a huge step forward, again, over what we have currently. And this should allow us to treat more of our patients who have cirrhosis, including those on the waiting list. So I'm going to shift to genotype 2-3. I'm going to take you through it kind of quickly, but this is now all oral therapy. Sofosbuvir 400 milligrams a day with weight-based ribavirin. This is genotype 2. So genotype 2, basically, you're going to cure most. That's the message. There does seem to be, in treatment experienced population, some role for extending the treatment duration from 12 to longer period of time, and I'll show you that on the next slide. Here, from 12 to 16 weeks doesn't seem to make a lot of difference. But here, if we look at genotype 3, we see quite a different picture. So, you know, genotype 2 and 3 are not the same, and 3 is now decidedly different and actually becoming the more difficult to treat genotype. So here's the same treatment, and you can see that I'm putting together here many studies into one slide just to sort of save you looking at a lot of bars. So there's here actually three different studies, but so they're not kind of directly head-to-head. But my message in showing you this is kind of twofold. One is that overall, the SVR rates in genotype 3 are lower than genotype 2, right? Because genotype 2, they're all 95 and above. Here we can see that in treatment naive patients, for example, that are treated for 12 weeks, it's a 60% response rate. And if you're treatment experienced and get 12 weeks of treatment, it's only 30%. Now, if you increase your duration of treatment from 12 weeks to 16 weeks in a treatment experienced population, you get up to 60%. And then if you take that treatment experienced patient and go up to 24 weeks, you can get up to 80%. So clearly duration of therapy matters for genotype 3 patients, and especially for patients that are treatment experienced. Cirrhosis still has an effect, and here again it's sort of the same. I'm focusing on the treatment experienced population, but you'll see in the cirrhotic populations that they always have SVR rates that are lower than what we see in the treatment naive, in the non-cirrhotic patient population. And again, we see that there's a benefit in your cirrhotic patient in having them treated for longer. So if we focus again on genotype 3, for example, so if you have a genotype 3 patient who is non-cirrhotic, you can see that they actually benefit from having 24 weeks of treatment, from 37 up to 87% in that non-cirrhotic patient. And then in the cirrhotic patient, we go from having 18% SVR rate if you are treatment experienced and get 12 weeks of treatment, and it goes up to 60% if you get 16 or 24 weeks of treatment. All right. Now, for the cirrhotic patient that's treatment experienced, you could argue, well, 24 weeks of sevoflurane and ribavirin, that's still only 60%. How do I get up to that 80 to 90% that I've actually come to be accustomed to? And the answer is probably you should use PEG interferon. So these are data from the Lone Star study. It's a relatively small number of patients, but I think a very informative study. So the cirrhosis patients are in the pink bars, and what you can see here is in a genotype 3 patient who's treated with 12 weeks of sevoflurane, PEG and ribavirin, now we get up to the 80% range, okay? And that's in patients with and without cirrhosis. So it's useful to know that for that group of patients that there still may be a role for PEG interferon. So to summarize, genotype 2, this is an incredibly responsive genotype for sevoflurane-based therapy with over 90% of patients achieving SVR with just 12 weeks of therapy. We do see there's some decrement in the cirrhotics and prior partial null responders, so those patients will probably benefit from longer duration therapy. Now, for genotype 3, in terms of 12 weeks of sevoflurane and ribavirin, I would say we need more. That's simply not enough. And 24 weeks looks better, certainly for the treatment-naive and non-cirrhotic treatment-experienced patient. But to my mind, the very best outcome for genotype 3, especially for those with cirrhosis, is to use 12 weeks of PEG interferon, ribavirin, and sevoflurane. Now let's shift to the transplant setting where really I have to say that this is probably for me the most exciting part of the AASLD meeting. So we were fortunate enough to participate in all of these studies. So we knew these results sort of before they were presented because we had patients that really reaped the benefits of being involved with these trials. So in this one, they took sevoflurane and ribavirin and applied it to waitlisted patients. Now, they were very specific about the waitlisted patients. They were targeting patients that were really Child's A. They had to have a Child's Pugh score under 7. Most of them were actually Child's Pugh score of 5. They had to be listed with with HCC, so we know those tend to be compensated patients, and have an anticipated time to transplant that was thought that the goal was to have them go to transplant within 24 to 48 weeks. They had to have creatinine clearance greater than 60, and they allowed both treatment-naive and treatment-experienced patients in. And they started out with 24 weeks. The treatment is ultimately amended to 48 weeks. And this is the results. On the left, the point of showing you that graph is just to show you that it's a rapid response. So you have about a 4-log drop within the first week of treatment, and most of them are undetectable by week 4. And if we look at the proportion of patients, oh, my bar shifted a little bit here, I see. So at the time of transplant, the first bar, 93% of patients were HCV RNA undetectable. And then we transplanted those patients on treatment, and 64% of them remained negative post-transplant. So we have prevented infection in 2/3 of the patients. It turns out that the duration of being negative influenced the likelihood of you having recurrent disease post-transplant. Now, remember, you can't always time transplant. So, you know, we put patients on treatment, and some of them went to transplant a week later, and some of them went a year later. So this is a bar just showing kind of the duration of therapy and relating it to whether they had recurrence. So the recurrence patients are in orange. Those without recurrence are in blue. And the message is just simple. The longer you're on treatment and the longer you're negative on treatment, the less likely it is you're going to have recurrence. And the cutoff seems to be somewhere around 30 days of being negative. But there's not a lot of patients that are in that sort of 1 week to 4 week time period. But it seemed like there was only one patient who had recurrence who was negative for 30 days, beyond 30 days. So if we're going to have to try to pick a time when we're going to start this treatment in our patients, we need at least 4 weeks for them to generally become negative. And then 4 weeks of negativity pretty much translates into those individuals being hep C free post-transplant. So the ideal, if you could sort of, you had a living donor, for example, and you could exactly time the transplant, you'd probably start your treatment somewhere between 8 to 12 weeks before the transplant. And the other thing is that it's very safe. So there were some deaths, but you know, you all know that deaths occur pre-transplant because things happen to patients because of their underlying liver disease. None of the deaths were due to treatment per se. And you can see that the actual AEs that led to discontinuation of study treatment was very small, only 3% of patients, and that most of the AEs are the things we sort of typically associate with ribavirin. And indeed, most of the side effects, as far as we can tell, there really isn't any that we can attribute solely to the sofosbuvir. So in terms of waitlisted patients, this is going to really, I think, going to transform the way we think about doing transplant. Our goal now is to have all of our patients who are on transplant is to time this kind of therapy to actually prevent infection. It's kind of a no-brainer in terms of the strategy. This is a small investment, a safe therapy that we can give our patients, and we're going to prevent it and then not have to worry about all of this management post-transplant. The challenge here, of course, is that these data are in Child's A patients. So we know that they're going to apply to our cancer patients very well and many of our living donors. The question is what to do with our MELD of 33. Is that patient safe on sofosbuvir and ribavirin? And I would say to you that we don't really have exactly the data, but we have some. And I'll share that with you shortly. So the next step is really what happens to the patients who already have recurrent hepatitis C. So this is a second study I'm going to share with you. Again, just sofosbuvir and ribavirin now being applied to patients who have recurrent hep C. And you can see there were genotypes 1, 3, and 4 here. Again, they limited the study to those that had relatively well-compensated disease. The results are on the right. And you can see that, again, high rates of response on treatment. 100% of them are virus negative after 4 weeks of treatment. And after 24 weeks of treatment with this dual therapy, 77% of patients remain virus free. Now, the number of patients that have reached SVR4 is only 27, but these I think we would view as very encouraging results as well. And then finally, I think the study that actually gives us the most confidence that we're going to be able to use these drugs in our patients with more advanced disease is actually from the Compassionate Access Program. So Gilead also made available sofosbuvir to investigators who really were desperate to get their hands on this drug, and I was among them. In fact, there were many, 115 of us that were trying to get our hands on this drug, I think. And what they did is they allowed us to get access to the drug if the patient had decompensated disease from recurrent hep C, so these are post-transplant patients, or if they had cholestatic hepatitis. So these are our sickest of the sick transplant patients, actually. So 115 of them treated. 45 received at least 4 weeks of sofosbuvir-containing regimen. A few of them got peg interferon as well, but most were just sofosbuvir and ribavirin alone. And really the encouraging thing is that 78% of them are virus negative on treatment. All of these patients actually remain on treatment. But the important thing is that 71% of them had ALT normalization and improvement in clinical status within 1 to 4 weeks of treatment. And it was shown to be safe. So I think for me, what I take away from this, because it's a nice sick transplant patient, is that maybe I can use this now in my sick pre-transplant patient. But recognize that there really are very, very limited data. Okay. So to summarize, if you look to what's going to be happening at UCSF and what you'll be hearing from us in terms of recommendations and plans, this is our approach to the patients with recurrent disease. We're going to My plan is to use PEG interferon, ribavirin, and sofosbuvir for 12 weeks in anybody who I think I can use interferon in. Why? Because it's 12 weeks of treatment, and the efficacy rate we think is going to be very high. For those that can't tolerate interferon or can't tolerate ribavirin, because you need to have it at adequate doses, those with decompensated disease, then sofosbuvir and ribavirin for 24 weeks will be a very appropriate move. And if I'm able to get my hands on sofosbuvir and sabizabulin, I certainly might consider using that as well in transplant patients, but recognize there is absolutely no data in terms of safety in that setting. So there are some nuances in using sabizabulin, I think, in a transplant population, but I think that would be potentially a very interesting combination also. I'm going to end with just a couple more slides. I'm sure I'm going to. All right. Mostly to tell you that we have other clinical trials that we're doing in our waitlisted patients and in our transplant patients. So I want to really make you aware of it because you may hear about your patients being approached to participate in trials. So I have the waitlist and I kind of peruse that waitlist to look for people that are appropriate for the studies. And certainly I do the same for the transplant patients. So we are currently doing a study with AbbVie. They have a cocktail of drugs, that including a boosted PI, an NS5A inhibitor, and a non-nuke. They have done a first study in transplant patients and plan to do a more expanded study in both patients with cirrhosis and transplants. And this is just to give you a flavor of like an all-oral regimen and what that looks like. So again, there are lots of cocktails out there, and I'll call them cocktails, but groups of oral agents that are achieving very high rates of SVR. This is not in transplant patients. This is in your treatment naive and on the right-hand side, null responders. But to just show you that when you put different classes of drugs together, we're now very consistently seeing SVR rates that are 90% or higher, approaching kind of 100% among our treatment naive and our treatment experienced population. So this is just an example of another group of drugs. These drugs are now are in phase 3 study as well. This is going to be something that we anticipate will be approved at some time in the near future. And here is yet another. We just actually were screening patients for this study today, not this study, but for a study that uses two of these drugs. This is sofosbuvir with a NS5A inhibitor, ledipasvir. And in this particular study, they were evaluating it using it with a non-nuke or ribavirin. Again, just showing that across the board, whether it's treatment-naive or treatment-experienced populations, very high rates of response. And as I was stressing at the beginning, the great news is that they're moving these studies into the transplant populations concurrently. So we're doing studies with this as well right now. So my final slide, I think management of HCV and the transplant future looks bright. Honestly, interferon-free regimens are our game changer. It's going to make my job disappear. I don't have to find a new disease. But happily, I will say. Pre-transplant is going to be, you're going to hear a lot more about us doing prevention, right? This is the strategy. We have a lot of transplant patients. Clearly, we need to treat those with recurrent disease. But the strategy going forward is about preventing. We have a very easy regimen that we can administer to patients to do this. So we're going to be, you'll hear much more about starting patients on the wait list on treatment. And then in terms of post-transplant, it's clear that we'll be able to eliminate PEG interferon, that we're going to have DAAs that are safer, less complex, less drug-drug interactions with the immunosuppression, and higher SVR rates. So my prediction is that we're going to see very few patients who are going to lose their grafts from recurrent hep C, and the need for retransplantation, for example, is also going to disappear. Thank you.
Thanks, Nora. Great summary of really exciting data. Any questions? Eddie.
Nora, since you've been telling the prediction, I asked you to
can repeat it.
Okay.
With the data, exciting data you showed, what do you think the real value of IL-28 in this error, if you will. Let's say you have a patient non-sclerotic, non-decompensating IL-28-TT. Would you wait? Would you treat the patient? And also, how do you think cost would play a role in the decision making? Because obviously, given the billion of this drug,
right.
How do you think that would play a role in terms of a clinician?
All right, so there's two questions. One is, what's the role of IL-28 going forward? And I think it's going to diminish and disappear. It's still useful, I think, right now because we are using some PEG-based therapy. And I think whenever you have PEG interferon as part of the treatment, I think there's some role. And I showed you data that with sacimipivir PEG ribavirin, sovosvir PEG riba, that there's still a differential there, and I think it can help you kind of have that discussion with your patient. But clearly it's going to disappear with time, and studies have shown that IL-28B has less impact as we go to more potent all-oral combinations. So I think you probably won't be doing it for much longer. Okay, so that's kind of a slightly different question. So, you know, I talked about cirrhosis, IL-28B, the subtype, all those things influence response. But we all know that actually the most important kind of predictor response is kind of what happens when they actually get on treatment. That's certainly true, I think, for sacimipivir PEG ribavirin. For example, the data suggests that if those individuals who got sacimipivir PEG ribavirin are negative by week 4, their SVR rate is in the 90% range, kind of doesn't matter what all the baseline stuff is. So probably the most important kind of marker is really on treatment response. Now, as our treatments are getting shorter, for example, if you look at sovosvir PEG ribavirin, we don't see those data because people, they're all pretty much negative at that time period. So maybe in that setting, we're having to look at some other predictors. But I wouldn't hold back somebody who's a TT. I don't think it's one factor. I would say that in most of the data, for example, with sovosvir PEG ribavirin, actually cirrhosis is more important. And if you look at sort of, you know, which ranks the highest, it's always cirrhosis, and then the other things are kind of lower down on the list. And then your sort of third question then really is about cost. And that is kind of the elephant in the room, I guess, in the sense that these are amazing therapies. And then the question is, like, how are they going to look when they get on the market, and where we're having to deal with insurers and, you know, getting access. And honestly, I don't know how that's going to play out. But I've always found that for cirrhotic patients and transplant patients, we can usually argue pretty compelling fashion that you have everything to gain from having this patient achieve SVR, right? I think for the F0s, that's where it's going to be interesting, I think. I think in the early disease, I think that's where we're going to see sort of an evolution in kind of how people think about treatment and who gets treatment. But for purposes of cirrhotics, transplant patients, for me, it's a no-brainer.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.